At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Lock your doors. Close the blinds. Change your passwords. This is the Dry Cleaner Cast. Welcome to the Dry Cleaner Cast, a podcast that takes a new look at the war on terror, its legacy, and espionage in the 21st century. This podcast is written, edited, and presented by Chris Carr.
This month, we're joined by author Jeremy Duns, and we are discussing the life and works of Ian Fleming. In the last section of today's chat, Jeremy will be discussing his new book on Ian Fleming, and in this book, there's some very interesting new information about Ian Fleming's activities during the Cold War. Some of them might be considered controversial, so do keep listening for that section. I just want to give a quick shout out to some of our listeners. I'd like to say hello to Penny Wint, to Shane Whaley, to Thomas Lumo, to Matt Fulton. I always enjoy our interactions. Thank you so much for following us on Twitter. Chris Kurgenven, I hope I pronounced that correctly. Abigail Clay, hello to Martin Gray, to Andrew Scott, Roger Doyle. I also want to say a shout out to some of our new listeners out there. Our listeners in Plumpton, Australia, in Paris, also to our new listeners in Tel Aviv, and to some of our regular listeners in Detroit, San Francisco, Washington DC, and as always, hello to our listeners in Moscow. If you enjoy what we do, please feel free to connect with us on Twitter by going to @drycleanercast. I run that account, so you'll be directly interacting with me, which might be a good or a bad thing, depending on how you look at it. I always enjoy hearing from our listeners. Also, don't forget to rate us on your preferred podcast platforms. We're on iTunes, Acast, Pocket Cast, just to name a few. So yeah, feel free to rate us on there. It really helps the show because it helps boost us up and helps people discover the show. If you're enjoying what we do, please do share it with your friends, family, co-workers, and maybe even your enemies. So thank you. I hope you enjoy this month's episode. And a quick disclaimer before we begin.
Opinions expressed by guests on this podcast do not necessarily represent those of the filmmakers and sponsors of the film, The Dry Cleaner.
Jeremy, welcome to the Dry Cleaner Cast.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me back on.
Yeah, no, is it your second visit now? I'm losing track.
It is, yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, good to have you back. Just for the benefit of listeners who may not have heard our previous episode together, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, my name is Jeremy Duns, and I am a writer. I've written several spy novels, four spy novels, and one non-fiction book. And I've also done some journalism, including two books about James Bond and Ian Fleming. One of them, Rogue Royale, is about a lost Bond script for Casino Royale from the 60s. And the other one, Diamonds in the Rough, is a collection of various articles about the literary and cinematic Bond universes.
And they're both very good, and actually partly inspired this conversation today. But we're gonna have a quick chat about Ian Fleming, because it was his 110th birthday.
Yeah, it was. Yeah,
on the 28th of May, which unfortunately I completely missed just because life got in the way. But I did try and have a vodka martini in his honour on the day. So Jeremy, what is it that inspired your interest in Ian Fleming and his work?
Well, I came to Ian Fleming a little bit in a roundabout way. I started becoming interested in spy fiction more generally when I was in my 20s. And then the more that I read, the more about spy fiction and the history of spy fiction, particularly British spy fiction. Of course, Fleming completely dominated the genre, and it's almost impossible to ignore Fleming if you look at that topic. And I mean, I'm, as you can hear, British, and I mean, if you're British and you grow up, you can't really avoid James Bond. You know, the films are on TV and all that kind of stuff. So obviously, I was familiar with the James Bond films, but it wasn't really until my 20s that I started looking at Fleming more closely. And then I was just massively entertained by his books. They're much more, I think, interesting than people give him credit for. And they're also, for me anyway, a kind of filter into lots of other things. I mean, they were obviously hugely influential on Cold War politics and on fiction, but also on fashion, on design, on, you know, advertising. And there's all sorts of other fields that that they had an impact on. So, you know, for that reason, I have quite a strong interest in it.
Yeah. And what do you think of the, just a very sort of just a very general question, what do you think of the films versus the books?
Well, I think a lot of people tend to say nowadays that, oh, you know, the films are very silly compared to the books, and the books are much more serious. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think there are some aspects of the novels that are more serious, and indeed the short stories tend to be grittier. But there's plenty of silly stuff in Fleming, and plenty of megalomaniacs. And I mean, Dr. No, for example, the novel is incredibly pulpish, as is Live and Let Die. But yeah, I mean, it's true that they tend to be a little bit more grounded, a little bit more down to earth. Obviously, you don't have so many car chases and explosions and all that kind of stuff. The films have kind of extrapolated from Fleming and made them bigger and bigger and bigger until you get, you know, a sort of massive kind of spectacular festival of explosions and gadgets and all that kind of stuff. But a lot of the DNA is still from the books, and I think Daniel Craig really captures a lot of what Fleming envisioned in the character of James Bond. He feels very much like he's the Bond of the books.
Yeah, and very much, I think, the unsung hero of James Bond, Timothy Dalton as well.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, Timothy Dalton, in a way, did what Craig is doing now, you know, well in advance, but perhaps too far in advance. People weren't quite ready for that after the Roger Moore era. But yeah, I mean, absolutely. If you watch The Living Daylights and then read the short story by Fleming, The Living Daylights, which is this, you know, really almost kind of Le Carré-esque spy story set in Berlin, you really see that Dalton, I mean, that is the character Dalton is playing. It's very, very closely hewing to what Fleming was imagining.
Yeah, because he was kind of close to resigning, wasn't he, and a bit sort of tired of his job. And it was, I mean, I've just been rewatching License to Kill, and there's something about that film I really like. It's a very interesting film.
It got a lot of flack, and I think, yeah, people had become used to the great spectacles and, you know, enormous stunts and explosions and all that kind of thing, and the kind of glamour and everything like that. And that was lacking, those elements were lacking in Dalton's films. But other elements, I think, were, I mean, the kind of the seriousness and the ethical framework, if you like. People tend to think that Bond, a lot of people, I think, tend to think that Bond is this sort of complete cad. But actually, he's quite moralistic in some ways. And he values duty, and he has some scruples, and he's a bit of a romantic at heart, actually, in the Fleming novels. And all of that stuff, I think, Dalton and also Craig have really focused on much more.
And I think that's probably what leads to his continuing appeal as a character. I mean, there are questionable things in both the books and the films. But those sort of core values seem to keep drawing us back, don't they? They give us this sort of sense of justice, you know, this guy out there sort of sorting out the powerful bad guys.
Yeah, it's very much an archetype. I mean, he's a Robin Hood figure, if you like, and you know, the Scarlet Pimpernel, and all of these kind of figures that you had from literature beforehand, you know, paved the way for this character. There were many other characters along these lines before Fleming came along, but this was a modern iteration of it, and one that fitted the Cold War so perfectly, and then took off that it's now become, you know, an icon in its own right. And I think one of the things also that attracted me to Fleming was, I think he hasn't been taken very seriously, because I think particularly in Britain, there's a weird idea that if something isn't serious, then you shouldn't take it seriously. And I think that's a bit of a conflation. Things can be fun, but they can still have an impact. They're still worth investigating. And I think, you know, Fleming really created an icon, you know, along the lines of, you know, Robin Hood or Sherlock Holmes. And so he, you know, the Beatles, the Stones, James Bond, I mean, these things are massive British icons that had a huge impact on 20th century history and continue to do so. And so I think just from that perspective, he's very much worth, you know, looking at.
I mean, it's probably a bit unfair to ask it, especially as I haven't warned you. Do you have any particular, is there a particular favourite Bond book or film that you keep kind of coming back to?
There's a couple. It's always difficult to narrow these down, but I really like Casino Royale, both the novel and Craig's portrayal of him in the film. But the novel particularly is very weird. It was the first novel, and that one, I think there is a very strong case. I mean, that is very dark. It's a short novel. It's almost a novella length, really, by today's standards. And it doesn't have, you know, it's sort of set mainly in one location in northern France. But it's a very brutal, ruthless, taut spy thriller. And the character of Bond is quite surprising if you're used to, for example, lots of Roger Moore films, and you read that, you would probably be quite shocked by that. But then I think they did a very, very good adaptation with Daniel Craig, and I think there's a lot of the elements in that novel they managed to successfully create and transform into film.
Yeah, it's difficult to actually make a film around a card game because not a lot of people are going to understand what's going on.
I mean, you know, success is always 2020, and before they made that film with Daniel Craig, I mean, of course, there was, first of all, a lot of criticism of the casting of Daniel Craig. That was his first film, and people couldn't imagine how that guy, that actor, would be the Bond that they had imagined. And then also, the only version that most people knew of Casino Royale at that point was the spoof version from the 60s, which, I think, being generous, was quite a messy film. And
yeah, I think the behind the scenes stories are more interesting than the actual movie.
Absolutely. And so a lot of people, you know, that film, first of all, that novel rather, it's you know, as you say, it's got a card game, takes up a lot of the action. It's got a very grim torture sequence that involves Bond's private parts. You know, how on earth are they going to film this and make it acceptable? You know, it's got a very famous last line where he says, "The bitch is dead." How, you know, a lot of people thought there's no way you could make a modern Bond film out of this book. And now, you know, they did it, and it was a huge commercial and critical triumph, and people have forgotten that. But there was a lot of skepticism that could actually be made, and they did an amazing job, I think, of actually deepening the character whilst keeping all of the things that people liked about the Bond films. But they get, somehow Bond became a more three-dimensional figure in that film.
Yeah, I still personally think it's Daniel Craig's best one. All the others are okay in comparison, but I still think there's just something about that story Yeah, it just hit so many beats well that it was very hard to sort of top, and I don't think they ever quite have. There's like the next film was a bit too self-conscious, and then the other ones are a bit too trying to be a Bond film and go back to the things they were trying to move away from.
Yeah, part of it could be that, you know, it really helped that they had the source material. So they, even if it's a short novel, there's a lot of Fleming in that film, so you know that helps.
Well, let's move on to the man himself. So Fleming's sort of history, can you just tell us a little bit about Ian Fleming's sort of early years?
I mean, he came from a wealthy background. His grandfather, Robert Fleming, was a merchant banker, and his father was a Conservative member of parliament. He was one of four brothers. There's a lot of military service in his family. His younger brother Michael died in the Second World War, and his elder brother Peter was also active in the Second World War, as was Ian himself. Peter was slightly overshadowed Ian Fleming for most of his life. Peter Fleming was this incredibly charming, witty man who really almost nobody, I don't think anybody had a bad word to say about Peter Fleming. Everyone seemed to have liked Peter Fleming who came across him. He was, first of all, an explorer, and then he was a travel writer. And he was a very famous travel writer. He was one of the best known writers in Britain. And, you know, as the James Bond thing has become, you know, a sort of global phenomenon, people have forgotten that. But Ian was the sort of younger brother of Peter Fleming. And in fact, not a lot of people know this, but when Ian Fleming submitted Casino Royale, his first novel, to the publisher Jonathan Cape, who owned, you know, the head of the publishing company, initially rejected the novel. And the reason why he eventually accepted it was essentially as a kind of favor, because they also published Peter Fleming. And it's like, well, we've got this thriller by Peter Fleming's younger brother, so I suppose we will take it on. And that was a sort of major contributing factor to Ian Fleming being published. So he lived a little bit, I think, in the shadow of Peter Fleming particularly. But also he was a little bit the black sheep of the family. He was a little bit, he didn't quite know what to do. He was a bit of a playboy, as one might expect from reading his novels. And he sort of drifted between a few different careers. He was a stockbroker for a time, and he was a journalist for a time, and it wasn't quite clear what he was going to do with his life. And really, the Second World War made Ian Fleming.
Yeah, and am I right in remembering his father died in World War One, and there was a connection to Winston Churchill that sort of, because I think from memory, Ian Fleming was very much an admirer of Churchill.
Yeah, Churchill wrote the obituary of his father in the Times. And if I remember it correctly, Ian Fleming always kept that. I mean, that was, I think, above his desk. So, yeah, he was... Yeah, he had quite a lot to live up to, I think. You know, his family had achieved a lot, and he was a little bit the layabout. So he was sent off to, you know, study German and French, and there was various things he tried, and I think his family was sort of slightly despairing of him. If you read the there's two excellent biographies, by one by John Pearson and one by Andrew Lycett, that go into a lot of detail about this. But yeah, I think he was sort of looking for. He wasn't as disciplined as the rest of the people, you know, the men in his family, and he was looking for something that would kind of give him direction in his life when the war came along.
World War II, he was sort of 31 years of age, and he was recruited into naval intelligence and became the personal assistant to Rear Admiral John Godfrey, who was then the head of British naval intelligence. What is known about Ian Fleming's sort of naval intelligence career?
So quite a lot has been written about that, and more has been declassified about British naval intelligence in the last few years. And Fleming, Ian Fleming, was not, behind enemy lines or anything like that. He wasn't a field agent. Peter Fleming, his brother, was really a kind of special forces guy. He was a commando. He was directly involved in the fighting and all that kind of stuff. Ian Fleming was the kind of PA, if you like, to John Godfrey. In the novels, there's a character called Bill Tanner, who's the chief of staff to M. And that's really what Ian Fleming's role was. He was a kind of right-hand man of Admiral Godfrey, and he was incredibly influential in that role. It was an incredibly important role. And he was the sort of ideas man for Godfrey, and he kind of represented Godfrey in Whitehall. And his forte, it became apparent quite early on, was coming up with ingenious ideas. Obviously, we now know him for that from his fiction. But before he was writing his fiction, you know, 15 years before that, he was coming up with all kinds of creative ways to try to defeat the Germans. So that was the main thing that he was doing.
And am I right in remembering he was involved in the there's a plot where they I think they call it, is it the man who never was?
Oh yeah, tangentially he was, yeah. So Godfrey was a sort of classic, you know, rear admiral type. M is, we think, partially based on him. And there is a memo that was sent around Whitehall in 1939, known as the Trout Memo, which is signed by Godfrey, but looks very much like it was probably, you know, thought up and written by Fleming, and he then put it in front of Godfrey, who agreed and signed it. And this was discussed in some detail at the beginning of Ben McIntyre's book about Operation Mincemeat, The Man Who Never Was. And one of the suggestions there was to do something that happened in Operation Mincemeat, which was, you know, when they kind of, you know, it was a deception operation where they faked. They took a soldier and a corpse, and they pretended that, you know, this was a British, you know, an accident that had happened, and he washes ashore and he has all sorts of papers on him, and the Germans would sort of, you know, read these and believe that they must be true. And there's something slightly similar in the Trout Memo. However, there were other, yeah, I mean, this might not be the actual origin of that operation, but Fleming was a specialist in coming up with this. I mean, a year after that, he came up with an operation that he codenamed Ruthless, which was slightly similar, where he had suggested that they stage a fake plane crash in the Channel using a German bomber and stuffed with British soldiers, a tough crew of five, he called them, in wearing German uniforms, and that they would then be picked up by a German U-boat, you know, trying to help out their comrades. And that they, as soon as they get onto the U-boat, they would storm it and steal the Enigma codebooks. So that's a little bit of a similar deception idea to Mincemeat. So he came up with, and that didn't happen in the end. Quite a lot of the plans he came up with didn't actually happen. He had another one where there would be someone who would be kind of stationed on an island in the North Sea, I think it was, who would kind of listen to lots of stuff going on. But a lot of them were deemed too risky or too bizarre, or, you know, too difficult, too impractical to carry out. But quite a few of his ideas sort of seeped into the thinking, and probably his greatest contribution, the idea that he really had, was actually taken from the Germans, which was Otto Skorzeny, the German commando, was specializing in this kind of thing where he would put German commandos in American uniforms and send them scurrying off to do all sorts of things. And Fleming came up with an idea which was eventually formed, called 30 Assault Unit, which was a British commando unit, which would go behind enemy lines and in advance of the troops, and would sort of scavenge all kinds of material, code books and you know, weapons and any documents that they could find and all that kind of thing. So he had quite, I would say, quite a large influence for someone in the position that he was in.
Yeah, and am I right remembering there's something called Operation Goldeneye, which obviously inspired the name of his house and in the subsequent movie?
Goldeneye was not really an operation. It was more a station. So in the Bond novels, Fleming sort of created this way of talking about things, so that the MI6 headquarters in Tokyo, for example, is known as Station J, J for Japan. And in a way, Operation Goldeneye was really the station in Gibraltar. So it was a it was a small group of people who would monitor what was going on in the straits around Gibraltar and protect Gibraltar. There was a stay behind cave and a network there, and Fleming was responsible for coming up with that idea and monitoring, you know, how they carried it out effectively.
So do we know, with regards to, we just mentioned Jamaica just now, so Ian Fleming obviously spent his last part of his life, half of his year, I think, at least, in Jamaica. What was it that drew Fleming to Jamaica? Is there a kind of war connection to that, or was it just a nice spot that he liked?
He had visited Jamaica during the war, and although it wasn't particularly a successful trip, he seems to have fallen in love with it. I think... you know, there are many elements. You know, the sun was shining. There's a sea, and he was a great lover of nature. I mean, you can tell. You know, if you think of the Bond novels with, you know, the, or even the Bond films with, you know, there's lots of exotic fish and animals and you know, all sorts of, you know, there's obviously Octopussy, the original short story is named after an octopus. Fleming loved to dive. He loved to swim. He was fascinated by flowers. The name James Bond comes from a book by an American ornithologist called James Bond about birds of the West Indies. So he was very, very interested in nature. And I think the main thing was that the atmosphere was just very relaxed and a million miles away from you know, the fog and the rain and the cold of London where he worked for the rest of the time. So it was a haven for him where he could just, you know, chill, if you like, to use a more 21st century term.
We'd all love it.
And who can blame?
Who wouldn't want a little place in Jamaica to go to once a year?
This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
Like what we're doing? Connect with us on Twitter at DryCleanerCast. Support the show by becoming a DryCleanerCast Patreon subscriber today. Go to patreon.com/drycleanercast. That's patreon.com/drycleanercast.
So at the age of 45, Ian Fleming sat down at his apparently his famous golden typewriter, and he created the fictional British secret agent James Bond. And his novels have obviously inspired one of the longest film franchises of all time. And as we're getting to sort of behind these adventures of James Bond, there's some real life moments from Ian Fleming's own history. So, Jeremy, can you just talk us through some of these real life moments that have influenced Ian Fleming?
The most famous one is probably the one that started it all off, which is Casino Royale. So you mentioned the card game. It's a game of baccarat, and this was inspired by a trip Fleming took to Portugal during the Second World War in 1941 with Godfrey, and they were on their way to the United States to kind of firm up naval intelligence's relationship with the States, but they staged in Portugal, and they also met some people there. But while they were there, they went to the casino in Estoril. And Fleming loved gambling. He was always fascinated by gambling. He'd been a gambler since he was very young. And he saw some German agents in the casino. And he had this idea that he would bet against the German agents, and by winning, he would help the Allied war effort. That was his idea.
Good excuse.
It's a good excuse. And he lost quite spectacularly. But that moment of being in a casino, and I guess the combination of the casino and the danger and the suspense and everything, you know, planted something in his brain. There's also there was a guy called Ralph Izzard who was in Naval Intelligence, who apparently had quite a similar experience, and he had sent a report back to Naval Intelligence about this that Fleming had seen. According to John Pearson in his biography, Fleming then immediately took Izzard, you know, out for a meal and, you know, probed him on all the details and what everyone was wearing and how exactly the hand had gone. But so that was the origin of Casino Royale, of the sort of main the main plot of Casino Royale.
Quick question, actually. Do we know if the casino in Portugal still exists?
It does, yeah. I've been there, yeah.
Oh, my God. See, I was just reading about this casino thinking, this would be a great holiday idea. My wife won't be too thrilled by this idea.
I mean, there's a whole school, you know, there's a whole lot of people who you know, write articles and books about, you know, the locations in you know, the Bond novels and films. So yeah, Estoril is a stop on the map, absolutely.
Oh, well, I have a feeling it'll be a future stop of mine.
That's probably the most famous. I'm just thinking is the other real life moments. So there was another one which, well, didn't influence Fleming, but influenced James Bond films. The James Bond film Goldfinger, I don't know if you remember, starts with this scene with either a seagull or a duck on a kind of black oily water harbor at night, and then as it kind of zooms in, a face emerges from underneath the bird and you realize it's actually Sean Connery. And then he steps ashore and he unzips his wetsuit and he's got a tux underneath. And that comes from a real operation that took place in 1941 that MI6 carried out in Holland. And I did some research on that quite a while ago now. And it's not entirely clear to me how exactly that got into that film. But I think that the most likely explanation is that Paul Dane was one of the writers of that film, and Dane had been very heavily involved in British intelligence during the Second World War and was an instructor for the Special Operations Executive. And I think that through the grapevine of British intelligence, he had probably heard. I mean, it's a bizarre idea. It's a very, very strange thing to want to do. And it was a sort of celebrated operation within intelligence circles in the UK. So I think that scene is a kind of tribute to that operation.
Yeah. And so this is a scene that's exclusive to the movies, but not in the books. I haven't read the book Goldfinger, to my shame. But
it's not in the book.
No.
And it was added, and I think it was added by the scene as a whole was not added by Paul Dane, but I think that part of the scene was added. And in fact, in his original drafts, it was quite a lot grimmer. It was not a bird. It was the carcass of a dead dog who Bond is hiding under, which gives you an idea of something a little bit more like real espionage. If you're a real secret agent, that might be the kind of thing that you might be forced to do. It might not be quite as glamorous as the depiction in the film. And in fact, the operation was not very glamorous at all. It was an operation to try to get in touch with Dutch resistance, and a lot of them had been betrayed. So it was an incredibly daring operation, but it wasn't a successful one.
No. And so other things that crop up in Fleming's novels, things like Smersh, which was, am I right in believing it was inspired by something that has some roots in reality?
Yeah, Smersh was real. Smersh was a real organization. It was a part of Soviet intelligence, in fact, counterintelligence. And Fleming had probably read about that. The first real stuff about that in the West came out in, I think, 1951. There was a book by a couple of Americans, and that was widely reviewed. And it had this aspect to it where it said that it was a contraction of death to spies in Russian, which Fleming used, and which, of course, is, you know, fantastically gruesome and sinister and very, very thrillery. And Fleming seized on it, but In his books, they are a very, very different type of beast than they were in reality. They were pretty awful in reality. But what they were really concerned with was treachery to the Soviet Union. They were a department that found people who had betrayed in some way the Soviet Union, tracked them down, interrogated them, and sort of handed them over normally to a gulag. So straight after the Second World War, for example, SMERSH agents were going around Germany and Austria and elsewhere into displaced persons camps and finding any Soviet citizens who either had collaborated with the Nazis directly or in some way had shown any kind of hostility or resistance towards the Soviets during the war. And they would interrogate them. And as I say, if they were found guilty, which I think they normally were, you know, that would be, you know, they would be shipped off and that would be the end of them. So that's a pretty sinister group, but in Fleming's hands, it became a sort of global group. And I think what Fleming was really looking for was a secret society, because Fleming was a huge fan of thrillers. He'd grown up reading thrillers. He grew up reading, you know, Sax Rohmer's Fu Manchu and Bulldog Drummond and all of these things. And in most of those early British thrillers, you have a secret society. So in The 39 Steps by John Buchan, for example, there's a group of German spies who are called the Blackstone, but often they're not necessarily linked so easily to one country. In the Fu Manchu novels, Fu Manchu is the head of a society called the Si Fan. In the Dennis Wheatley novels of the 40s, you have the Gang of Seven, where you have, you know, there's a sort of Japanese guy, a German guy, you know, different financiers and all these kind of things. So I think Fleming was looking for a kind of all-encompassing, massive conspiracy, if you like, that would provide a suitable villain, an opponent for Bond to go up against in several books. And for his first few, that was SMERSH. And then he changed it to Spectre, I think because in his view, the Cold War, it was a little bit counterproductive, you know, and it was a little bit cliched as well to constantly be blaming the Russians for everything. And at some of the books with SMERSH in, it's very tenuous. I mean, Le Chiffre owes money to SMERSH in Casino Royale. In Goldfinger is the treasurer of SMERSH. In Live and Let Die, I mean, Mr. Big is a, you know, Caribbean voodoo, fake voodoo god who's also a New York gangster who's somehow working for SMERSH. So it didn't quite make sense. So he changed it.
Yeah, that makes it makes sense. Yeah, with Spectre, because then, yeah, as you're saying, otherwise it does become a bit predictable. It's always the Russians, and
yeah,
I think that's one of the challenges of spy fiction, actually, because it can, if you're not careful, it can come across as being a bit racist, can't it? Because you're just constantly targeting a particular country.
Yeah,
and
I mean, yes. I think actually, I'm not sure. I mean, there are things in the Fleming novels which are pretty much along those lines. I think some of the comments about, you know, Koreans and Goldfinger, for example. But I'm not sure Fleming would have used the word racist. But yes, I think that was his concern, that, you know, I'm just constantly, you know, the Russians are the baddies the whole time. So I need to figure out a way of making it something else. So let's just have, Spectre is a group that isn't ideologically allied to any one country. It's in it for themselves. They just will, you know, blackmail or extort anyone, whoever the highest bidder is. And they're made up of people from, they are made up of some people from SMERSH and from other, you know, organizations, you know, criminal organizations around the world. So that way he had something that he could really use wherever James Bond was. It would be plausible that Spectre might have an interest, whereas for the Russians to be interested, I mean, it's even from the beginning, it's a very, very weird idea that, you know, Soviet intelligence is so fascinated by, you know, one guy who owns some brothels in northern France that they're going to send, you know, an agent to kill him. It's not particularly plausible. Having said that, we're talking about Ian Fleming here. So, I mean, he wasn't always interested, let's say, in the most plausible espionage plot. But in that way, I think he did make it a little bit more plausible. SMERSH also was not existing by the time he started writing about them. SMERSH closed down in the 40s. So even by Casino Royale, SMERSH, where he introduced SMERSH in fiction, it wasn't a real organization anymore.
And I can assume a lot of members of the general public probably weren't aware of that, were they?
No, it was a pretty obscure thing. And in a way, he was doing, it was already a way to do what he did with Spectre, which was instead of just having the KGB or the NKVD or the MGB, as they were also called, he had a slightly more obscure organization within Soviet intelligence that most people wouldn't have heard of. So he'd already made it a little bit more interesting. Mm. And I think that that's what Fleming really, that's what makes the books so brilliant, is that he had a great eye for interesting information, and he could take fairly hackneyed plots, ideas that had been done a million times before in thrillers, and he would just find a new piece of information or a new spin on them that would just sort of kick it into another gear. So rather than just having the same old thing, suddenly you have this fantastically sinister sounding smirsh. So that's I think what his great talent was, and it's almost in every paragraph of one of his books you find stuff that is like that. It's like, oh, I didn't know that.
Mm. Yeah, it's good fun for Googling, isn't it? As you're reading.
Yeah.
And I love with Bond his sort of obscure knowledge about things, like particular vintages of alcohol and stuff like that.
Yeah, there's slightly less of that in the books, but I think, yeah, to a large degree, that was why Fleming was successful, was because, of course, people couldn't Google stuff in those days. So he was really introducing, a lot of information, new information to people that they didn't know and they didn't have access to. So it was a kind of, it was an insider feel to what he, this is what it's really like. This is what Jamaica's actually like. Most people had never visited Jamaica. You know, this is what it's really like in a bar in Paris. And these are the real, it's a bit like a sort of travel guide where, it says, these are the places to go that are off the beaten path that the tourists don't normally go to. That's kind of the appeal of the Fleming novels, where he would recommend and discuss things that were a little bit of a connoisseur's, information that you wouldn't normally be able to get access to.
Yeah. Now, is there a definitive answer to who the inspiration of the character of James Bond himself is?
No, not really. I think about as definitive as you can get is the main inspiration is himself.
Yeah.
He's a fantasy figure of Ian Fleming himself. As I said before, Fleming wasn't a field agent. He wasn't in the Second World War or afterwards working behind enemy lines. And indeed, he was forbidden to do so because it was felt that he knew too much and that if he'd been captured by the Germans, he would have given away far too much information. But he knew a lot of people who were. He knew a lot of commandos, of course, his brother and other people. And so it's kind of a fantasy of, had he been a man of action, this is what he would have liked to have been like. James Bond's tastes are quite, by and large, the same as Fleming's. He dresses, he has the same taste in clothes as Fleming. He has the same taste in drinks and women. These are all Fleming's own tastes. In terms of the secret agent side of him, I think he was very influenced by commandos he'd known, people who were in 30 Assault Unit, people like Ralph Izzard, people like Patrick D'Eldrob. And I think also, a major, major influence was his brother, Peter. Peter, as I said before, his reputation isn't as, he's not as well known now, of course, as Ian, but he had an amazing life. There's a fantastic biography of him that was written in the 70s by Duff Hart Davis. And he's just a completely amazing. He really had an amazing war, and he was involved. He was with the commando mission in Greece. He was reported dead in Norway, and he was a real. That guy was a real James Bond, with the exception that he wasn't a womanizer or anything like that. He didn't have that kind of the black sheep thing that Ian had. But in terms of the action that he faced, he was heavily involved in deception operations in the Far East. So I think a lot of the action side of Bond comes from Peter Fleming.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, I suppose he would have heard all the stories when they have caught up, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Do we know, sorry, it's a bit of a random question now, but, and probably a bit of a populist question, but do we know the actual origins of the vodka martini shaker not stirred? Because I'm under the impression it came from Bill Donovan in the States, but I could be completely wrong on that one.
Ooh, that could be. I feel like I'm in the last seconds of a mastermind round here. I'm not sure. I think, I mean, one of the things is with something as big as Bond and Fleming is there's a lot of Chinese whispers, and there's a lot of, you know, urban myths, if you like, and a lot of stories get told lots of different ways. So, I mean, the code name 007, there's about five competing stories about where he got that from. The Vespa, I can't, I'm struggling to remember where exactly that comes from. But, I mean, it might just have been as simple as that he came up with the character's name and then thought that would be good and a good name, you know, a good way for Bond to pay tribute to and thought of a, thought of a drink that would suit. But I've no doubt that the sort of inside bit of information that he's giving, the connoisseur's bit, which is the shaken, not stirred, whether or not that is true or not, that it's better to have your vodka martini shaken rather than stirred, which I'm sure there's a lot of debate about. But that detail that he's put in is part of this thing, that he's not just ordering a vodka martini. He's going to tell you, the real way to get it right. And that's the kind of thing that you're going to want to read his novels for.
Yeah, exactly. And that drink has gone on ever since.
Yeah, have you ever had one?
I have. I've had a few, actually. I prefer. I've my personal preference is actually a Bombay Sapphire Martini.
Okay.
So I go with gin rather than vodka, but I do like vodka martinis. But for some reason I prefer find the gin one a bit more satisfying, and I kind of call it my holiday drink because I only seem to drink it when I'm on holiday.
Okay, that sounds very James Bond.
It does.
My holiday drink. I just go to the bar and order my holiday drink. I can't see it. I can't see Daniel Craig saying that.
No, exactly. How about you?
I don't really drink. I'm more of a wine person, so I don't really drink hard liquor. Sorry, very boring on me.
That's all right. Have you? So you've never had one, or you?
I think I have. I have had one, but it didn't really do anything for me.
No, fair enough. It is a bit like rocket fuel. I remember
it was. Yeah, exactly like that. Yeah.
Yeah, because I think my first one actually was in 2007. And it was with my friend Nejad, and we both had one, and he hated it. So I ended up drinking his as well. He absolutely hated it, and I didn't mind it. But it is quite a powerful drink.
I always think also that barmen or people working behind bars must be so bored.
Yeah, I know.
People coming up and saying, "Can I have a vodka martini? Shaken, not stirred, or whatever they do."
But well, I let them decide that. But I was a bit embarrassed when I went up to the bar. I didn't do the defiant sort of like a vodka martini shaken, not stirred. It was more like I'd like a vodka martini, and then left there to work out.
Yeah.
And ask, how would you like
that's
that?
Very British, and that's something Bond is very British. But that's one thing that he doesn't have, which is that sort of sense of reticence and shame that most British people have. But Bond is not apologising the entire time, whereas most Brits tend to do that. So perhaps that's a bit unrealistic in Fleming's work.
It's true. Vodka martinis aside, are there any other stories that we haven't touched upon that you find interesting about some of Ian Fleming?
Well, I think, as he went on, I think he became a more interesting writer. He became more interested in the real workings of the Cold War. And I think, you asked me earlier what my favorite of the novels are, and I said Casino Royale, but I would also highlight From Russia with Love, which I think is a really fantastic thriller. Pretty straightforward, and it's not an outlandish one. It's more like an Eric Ambler thriller. Fantastic evocation of Istanbul. And for that book, there's a lot of real espionage stuff in there. There's a lot of things that he had got access to. So there was a Russian defector, Grigory Tokayev, who was he was an aeronautical engineer with the Soviet Air Force, and he defected to the British sector of Berlin in 1947. He was one of the big defectors, and Fleming was put discreetly in touch with him, and quite a lot of the stuff about Soviet intelligence comes from that defector. And there's lots of references to real-life operations and real-life espionage, the Berlin Tunnel, and lots of other things in that book. So I think that's quite interesting. And then I think the other thing that I'm most interested in his writing, or my personal preference, is actually for the short stories. So I think he really matured as a writer when he was doing the short stories. A lot of people don't like them because they're nothing like the films, mostly. But I think that The Living Daylights is a really brilliant short story, and would surprise a lot of people. If you think Fleming's not for you, just try reading that short story. And see what you think. And then I think also Octopussy, which is a very weird story and came out after he died, but is a kind of self-portrait, and a very cutting self-portrait of a British guy living in the Caribbean off ill-gotten goods. And Bond comes and visits him and reminds him of something he did that was wrong in the war. And it sort of reads a bit like a suicide note in a way. It's a very, very depressive story. But it's a brilliantly written story in the vein of Somerset Maugham's short stories. So I think a lot of people have a kind of bit of a black and white view of Fleming. But I think that there's quite a surprising range across his work of different types of story.
Yeah, no, he is a very interesting read, and yeah, I've always been a big fan. I you know, On Her Majesty's Secret Service is such an interesting one. Both the film is a I like the film a lot. It's sort of grown up. I'm still not sure about George Lazenby, but the novel and the film are quite close, and it's a really interesting story. I like that one.
Yeah, and I think I don't think I can. I need to be in too fearful of spoiler alerts, but obviously the ending of that is quite unusual, if you like, in that goes against what we know, you know, what we think of about James Bond. I mean, he gets married, you know, there's a real love story there. So I think he was always, he got bored very quickly. He was a very restless man. And I think he was always trying to push what he was doing. He started writing late. He died early. But he was always trying to push with each book into doing something completely different. The End of From Russia with Love, you think James Bond is dead. He took a lot of risks. And a lot of the things that he did, we now take for granted because, you know, so many others have followed in his footsteps. That we just forget that actually, you know, Fleming was the person who really set the British spy novel alight.
Yeah, definitely. There's actually a very interesting book, isn't there, about Ian Fleming and the kind of the post-war years. I can't remember the name of it now. Is it not Royal Britannia? It's something about Ian Fleming and the sort of 50s and how he inspired people to kind of pick themselves up a bit, but I can't remember the name of the book now.
Are you thinking perhaps of Simon Winder's book?
It could be.
There's been so much written about Fleming, but that's another thing I find interesting is that I kind of presumed when I started to become very interested, you know, wow, there are all these, you know, coffee table books and documentaries and so many, you know, so much about Fleming that there can't be anything left to find out. But actually, there's quite a few things that have not been looked at, and there's always more. You know, there's always something else that you can explore.
Yeah, and it makes him such an interesting sort of figure. I've actually just purchased one of the biographies about him, just because I was thinking of something to read over my upcoming holiday.
Which one have you got?
It's out. I'll go onto my Kindle and tell you. 2 seconds. I was reading the Amazon reviews, and one got slated, and I thought, oh, okay. So this one's the John Pearson, Life of Ian Fleming.
That's very good. That was written. They started writing it while he was alive. Actually, Leonard Russell, who was the features editor at the Sunday Times, started writing it, and then he handed over to Pearson. And it was the first major biography. It came out, I think, in 1966. And it holds up very, very well. It's a very good book.
Excellent. Have you ever seen any of the biographical films? Most of them are not very good, but there's a few of them.
Ages ago, I think I saw one with Charles Dance.
GoldenEye, that one, yeah.
Yeah, but no. And I did also see most of – there was a TV series a few years ago.
There was Fleming.
I saw most of that. But I mean, that – I mean, that was great fun, but yeah. I mean, it was, you know, quite a long way away from what actually happened, I think.
Yeah, because it's a bit, that's the thing, like, it's they always seem to, I don't know, I suppose they were trying to take it in that sort of very popular James Bond route, but there's some tragic moments, like when there was a woman he was dating who was killed in an airstrike, and I would love to have known a bit more about that and how it actually affected him. They kind of just, it's a strange moment in the Fleming film.
Well, Chris, you are reading the right book on your Kindle.
Oh, good.
Because, if I'm not mistaken, that was their source material for that series. And I'm pretty sure Pearson talks about that incident in quite some detail.
Yeah, because I wondered if... because Bond is quite a tragic figure, isn't he, with his romances. And I just wondered whether there was something connected to the death of that woman he was involved with in World War II.
Yes, I think absolutely there was. And I think this is the thing, is that people, you know, it's there's a lot more to it. There is, I mean, Fleming, you know, died pretty young, and his attitude, he was... you know, he was smoking far too much and he was drinking far too much, and his doctors warned him about this. And his attitude was, you know, to hell with that. And he gave Bond this motto, which is, "I will not waste my days in trying to prolong them." And that is really his own attitude towards life. So there was often in the books, there's this word that he continually uses, ennui. So he was, I suppose, what we would now call depressive. He was a very melancholy figure in many ways. And the success of Bond was a bit of a double-edged sword to him. It's what he really wanted, but he found a lot of pressure. And as I say, he stretched himself. He didn't simply repeat the formula. That it is not simply the case that, you know, all the Bond novels are, you know, here's the villain, they've got their megalomaniac plot to overtake the world, and that's it. There's an enormous amount of range, and particularly, you know, in things like his relationship with Tracy and Vesper, even in the first novel, there is quite a tragic undertone to quite a lot of his work.
And I think that's, for me, as I've got older, I've sort of latched onto that and found it very interesting. You know, because I think, like you were saying earlier, being British, you kind of grow up with James Bond. Roger Moore was my childhood Bond until Timothy Dalton took over in the late 80s. And I've always, License to Kill is always that kind of, for me, a kind of coming of age movie. I was like 10 when I first saw that, and it was very different. I was like, wow, this is really interesting. And then it kind of, and then, nothing was quite the same after that.
Yeah. And I think in one way, you know, it survived because there are these different versions and you can sort of pick which one. But for me, definitely the Bond of Casino Royale, of From Russia With Love, of On Her Majesty's Secret Service, The Living Daylights, The Story, and Octopussy. I mean, these are, I think, you know, these deserve to be taken seriously as writing. And yeah, there is something underlying, there is a kind of darkness underlying the glamour there.
Okay, let's move into our final section. Now, Jeremy, you've got a new book coming out about Ian Fleming. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's hopefully going to be out in about a week's time, and it's called Agent of Influence. And it's about a friend of Ian Fleming's, in fact, who was a guy called Anthony Terry. And he was a journalist who worked at the Sunday Times for most of the Cold War. And he was a correspondent for something called Mercury, which was the Sunday Times, was part of a newspaper group. And Fleming ran, I believe it was 86 of these correspondents all over the world. And it was called the Mercury Network. And a lot of them were MI6. It was a cover for MI6.
Okay.
And so it's focused on Anthony Terry, and it's about how he influenced Fleming. So how a lot of the stuff that he reported on, a lot of the knowledge that he had, Fleming used in his novels. But it's also about John le Carré, about Frederick Forsyth, and about a few other people. But what it's also about is espionage. So we talked about earlier about Fleming's wartime experiences with intelligence, and there's been a lot written about that. But I have been surprised how little has been written about Fleming during the Cold War. And the fact is that while he was writing the James Bond novels, Ian Fleming was working for MI6. And this is something that's kind of a little bit in between the lines of the current literature. And so I'm kind of I'm sort of extracting that, if you like, and taking that bit out, and how MI6 used Fleming, how they used other journalists for propaganda purposes, the propaganda elements of the Bond novels, and how this kind of activity, the ethical considerations of it, but also how it shaped perceptions during the Cold War. The Bond novels were an enormous weapon during the Cold War. They were a huge Western advantage during the Cold War in the cultural standoff between East and West. We had James Bond, and he was a kind of beacon for freedom. And I'm looking in a lot of detail. It's a sort of close reading of newspaper archives, of I'm sort of triangulating various memoirs, and I'm trying to pick out how exactly this was done.
Wow, it sounds like a brilliant book. And I'm assuming there's not much of official released material.
Well, there's a surprising amount, really. There was something called the Information Research Department, which was a Foreign Office propaganda unit set up by the Labour government in 1948, and they were behind things like, for example, I mentioned Tokayev earlier. They were behind that guy, and there's quite a bit has been released from them. There are various, the MI6 has released nothing, but I mean, I found all kinds of references to, you know, MI5 information. I mean, Anthony Terry was he was a commando. He was involved in the Saint-Nazaire raid, and he was captured by the Nazis. And he became obsessed with Nazi war criminals. So a lot of the stuff about, you know, Martin Bormann disappearing and you know Nazi treasure and all of these kind of things, this really leads back to his reporting. So the Odessa file, for example, was started off because Frederick Forsyth read Anthony Terry's Sunday Times journalism about it. And there's quite a surprising amount in the CIA files about this. But probably the biggest source, I mean, Anthony Terry's stepdaughter found all his letters and all his file. He had a huge kind of filing cabinet of stuff, and he died kind of slightly unexpectedly, slightly before he thought he was going to die, and he didn't destroy all of it. And so she came out with a thin biography. It's not very long, several years after that, that has a lot of, you know, just verbatim letters between him and Fleming, between him and MI6 agents and operatives, and all kinds of weird stuff that you would not think would be in the public domain. And really an admission, I mean, a straightforward confession by Terry that he was working for MI6, because we all associate, you know, it's not that surprising that MI6 use journalists. We kind of think of journalists as sometimes working as spies. But actually finding examples of that in the Cold War in Britain, hard evidence of it, is there's not that much of it. So I've tried to sort of put together a lot of that stuff, and some of it's quite weirdly, you know, in odd places. So there was a biography of John le Carré that came out, I think, 5 years ago by Adam Sisman, and he talks in that about how when le Carré was at Oxford as a student, I don't know how much you know about le Carré, but his dad was a kind of con man.
Yes, yeah.
And his, as a result, all his dad's kind of businesses were going bust, and he couldn't afford to pay the fees. So it looked like le Carré was going to have to leave Oxford. And le Carré was already spying for MI5 at that point. And they introduced him. This is all in Sisman's biography. And MI5 were worried. And so they introduced him to MI6 and the editor of the Sunday Times, and they hatched this plan that le Carré would be a foreign correspondent for the Sunday Times, a left-wing correspondent, and he would be so respected as a left-wing correspondent. This was a long-term plan, decades-long plan, that he would, you know, be able to go to, you know, Prague and Budapest and all these places. And of course, he would be met by, you know, left-wing groups, yeah. and he would then be able to report back to MI6. Now, this plan never took place, but Le Carré didn't do that. But if he had done that at that time, he would have been reporting to Ian Fleming at the Sunday Times. Fleming would have been his boss. Now, that last bit is not in Sisman's book, but because I know what Fleming was doing, when I read that, I thought, hold on a minute. So there's a lot of that kind of thing where it's like different pieces of information by themselves might not seem that interesting. But then when you put them together, you get, you know, something that's a little bit more than has already come out.
Yeah, it just sounds absolutely fascinating. And actually, you know, it's quite, it's very controversial way. The only reference I've ever heard of with regards to MI6 and journalists was with Richard Tomlinson's book, The Big Breach, because one of his criticisms of MI6 was their use of journalism as a cover because it endangers actual journalists.
Yeah, that's a common criticism, and that's something I discuss in this book. I mean, as you can tell, I've been down several rabbit holes with this. But my interest really started a few years ago when I was researching one of my novels, and I was tracking down some papers from a British journalist, a clippings file, and there was a whole load of stuff from the Soviet press alleging this in the 60s. And I looked at that more closely, and I did a short documentary for Radio 4 about this. I think it's called MI6 in the Media, and I think it's probably still on the BBC's website. And when I was doing that, I think it's only like, I don't know, 25 minutes, half an hour long. And a lot of the people I interviewed talked about Fleming, particularly Nigel West talked about how connected Fleming had been with MI6. But unfortunately, as you will know from your day job, you don't always have time for several narratives. So I was sort of faced with a situation where either I kind of went with the broad narrative I already had, or it became a kind of James Bond fest and a James Bond program. And so I didn't have any of the Ian Fleming stuff in it, but it always stuck with me, particularly Nigel West, you know, quite detailed discussion that we had, in which he was really insisting, you know, Fleming was very, very, you know, not mobbed up, but he was very spooked up. You know, he was really in connection a lot with MI6, and they were not exactly guiding, because the best propaganda works if you keep a sort of very loose leash, because then he could go a bit crazy and do all sorts of stuff. But in the end, you know, you could rely that Ian Fleming is going to create something that will make us look good. So it was a sort of, I would hesitate to call it outright propaganda, but he was definitely helped. He was working with MI6. He was knowingly providing cover for MI6 operatives working at the Sunday Times. And some of the journalism that Anthony Terry was doing and others, who was it serving? Was it serving the readers? Were they trying to get the best story? Or was this a kind of disinformation or propaganda? You know, were they trying to beat the Soviets, or make a point about what the Soviets were doing and kind of get one up on them there? So that's kind of the theme, if you like, of the book.
Yeah, and I suppose tactic-wise, it sounds to me like it's very much of the World War II mentality, isn't it? Of that kind of black propaganda and all that.
Yeah, I mean, most of the people who were these correspondents for Mercury, which was, I mean, if you like, Fleming was the kind of M figure of this. He was controlling this network of correspondents, and a lot of them had been involved in British intelligence during the Second World War. And so, obviously, if you're MI6... you move into the Cold War, rather than start from scratch, it's quite a good idea to get people who you already know are up to the job, for example, speak fluent German or French or Russian, know the ropes and are discreet and know what to do. So a lot of the biographies of a lot of very well-known journalists in the Cold War, if you look at them, they will say, was attached to, you know, British intelligence in the Middle East during the Second World War. And of course, one reason why this hasn't had more focus is because this is so much closer to us, but also the Cold War didn't really end in the same way. You know, Ian Fleming during his lifetime was pretty open in interviews about what he had done during the Second World War, but obviously he wasn't going to give interviews and say, by the way, I'm still working for MI6 now. He was not going to blow his own cover. And there was no definitive point where anyone said, you know, even after the collapse of the Soviet Union, no one was suddenly going to pop up and say, by the way, you know, that's what I've been doing. So it's gone much more under the radar than, and it's much more of a gray area, because the Second World War, we're very clear about, you know, we won, the Nazis were evil, and that's it. So for that reason, I thought it's worth digging into a bit more, I think.
No, definitely. I mean, I'm assuming that people thought the Cold War would end a lot faster than it actually did. It's such an interesting topic, actually. Is there much evidence that you've seen that it kind of continued on the years after Fleming, or did it kind of fizzle out as a tactic?
Do you mean, is it still being done?
Well, yeah. Do you think it is still being done?
I think it probably, to some degree, is still being done. And, you know, it will be up to people, you know, the next generation, if you like, of espionage historians. Because, you know, MI6 has not declassified, you know, things, you know, anything post-war. So it will be very difficult to find out. But yeah, here and there you get hints. And I mean, I'm not claiming, by the way, to don't want to give the wrong impression. I'm not claiming this is an entirely new discovery. It is known that Fleming had intelligence links. But what I'm trying to do is sort of put more of a spotlight on that and investigate it more. Frederick Forsyth had a memoir that came out, I think, 2 years ago now. And he, for the first time, admitted in that he had worked with MI6 during his career as a sort of roving agent, if you like. And, you know, obviously he had denied, you know, he had never admitted that before. So we're finally getting to the stage where there are a few admissions of this from the Cold War era. But I think it will be many years. I mean, if someone were doing that today, I think it will be many, many more years before we would find out about it.
Yeah, it's usually people's retirement age they decide to get a bit honest, isn't it?
When it doesn't matter anymore, yeah. it's when they get a bit honest, yeah.
Am I right remembering that the KGB used to buy up the Fleming novels and make their officers read them?
I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, how would we know? I think. I mean, I've heard various versions of that, that they also used to watch all the films and all that kind of stuff. I mean, there was massive interest, and the Soviet media did try to undermine the Bond films, particularly, but also Fleming. And there was all kinds of propaganda against them. There were attempts to have Soviet versions. There was a Bulgarian thriller writer who had his own hero who goes up against the villain, who's called 007, until Fleming's estate intervened, and then he was called 07. That's a guy called Andrei Guliashki. He manages to kill Bond, I think, in the end. But you know, it was definitely felt as a propaganda force in the Soviet Union.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know every time a Bond film comes out, there's always an obligatory interview with whoever's the head of MI6, where they say something in the lines of, Bond's not the type of person we're looking for, but he is an incredible recruitment tool.
Yeah, and I think he has been an extraordinary recruitment tool. I think that's been underplayed, even though those interviews always say it. The image of British espionage is James Bond, essentially. I mean, you can talk about George Smiley or Harry Palmer, but, you know, it's a... There's an aspirational image to Bond, despite the fact that, you know, he's a cold-blooded, you know, assassin at certain points. He's got all sorts of terrible attitudes. He's incredibly unfit in some ways as well. And I think on the first page of Casino Royale, he's having his 70th cigarette of the day, which would not make him get past many obstacle courses. But nevertheless, I think around the world, you know, Bond has been this kind of you know, flag bearer for both Britain, but also for the reputation of British intelligence and MI6 in particular.
Well, Jeremy, thank you so much for this chat today. That is very interesting. Where can listeners find out about you and your work?
Probably the best place is to go to my website, which is jeremy-duns.com, and that has you know, blurbs on all of my books, and it also has at the bottom of the page a link to my Twitter page and my Facebook page as well. So that's probably the best.
Brilliant. Cool. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
For more information about the podcast, visit our website at drycleanercast.co.uk. Thanks for listening.
This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.